Well, today, as most of you know, we're going to have a little ceremony after the talk. I really don't know. So this ceremony is to a kind of installation ceremony to recognize or install Karen as the teacher, the main teacher of the Bozeman Zen Group. Last time I was here, last year, Wendy and Karen and I talked about this, and we came to an agreement that it would be a good thing for the Bozeman Zen Group, as well as for Wendy and Karen. And I'll give a little history. Wendy studied Zen in the Bay Area at Zen Center. Reb has been her teacher, Reb Anderson. She studied, actually, she spent a year at the Berkeley Zen Center studying when she was getting her degree at Cal, University of California, Berkeley. 14 years ago, she started the Bozeman Zen Group. All of my information may not be totally accurate, but it's pretty close. She started the Bozeman Zen Group, and we want to honor her for that, which is, without that, there would be no Bozeman Zen Group. And she's really given herself as much as she is able to, given a busy family life, and making the group work all this time. I think it was 12 years ago that Karen came.
Almost 12 years.
And together, they have been cooperating to make the Zen group work. The two teachers. Karen spent a lot of time practicing in the Bay Area at Zen Center, at San Francisco Zen Center, and also she spent a year at Tassajara, which is a very good credential. And then she came to Berkeley at some point and was practicing there with me and as a resident for many years. And every year we have a practice period, a six-week practice period, and we have a head student called Shuso at Tassajara. We have that. You probably, if you've been to Zen Center and done a practice period there, you know that there's always a head student, the Shuso, who studies, who helps the abbot during that time and has a prominent position. So she was Shuso for a practice period some time ago. And so, being a resident, she has a lot of experience in how to make a group work, a Zen group work. At some point, I gave her lay entrustment as a lay teacher. That's why she has the green roxu. I actually invented there was always this feeling that in the Zen, the priests and the lay people, right? And most of the people who practice, like in a place like mine, are lay people, not everyone, but so, and the lay people grow, and pretty soon everybody's kind of teacher material at some point. And so I was always concerned with how do we recognize lay teachers? Not everyone should be a priest. So And this has been boiling, you know, at Zen Center. And so I took the initiative and I created the lay entrustment position. So so I gave her lay entrustment, which stipulates that she can lead a Zen group. She can do many things. She can't give ordination. Ordination is a priest's job. That's a priest, they ordain people. But if she wants to, if people want to be ordained with her, then she would do it together with me as the ordination teacher, and with her as the teacher of the person who wants to have the ordination. So I've done that many times with people. People who have lay entrustment, we do the ordination together. So, but she is fully qualified in my eyes as a lay teacher. So we're giving her that opportunity to express. How long ago was that?
10 years.
10 years ago. Well, that's pretty good. We do, you know, when we give a person permission to teach, we send them off for 10 or 20 years, you know, to work in a bakery or something, you know. And then appear in the world. So we wanted to give her, we wanted to give her this opportunity to express her position. So I really want to thank you so much for cooperating with all of us. Do anybody have any questions about this or about anything? The dumbest questions are the best, you know. Sergio, you might have a really stupid question.
It's really interesting that you would do this, because I was kind of thinking about the subject of how sanghas grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how sanghas grow. Yeah.
Trust sanghas. And I was, you know, thinking of the statement you said in one of your talks yesterday about the destination of the Zen student is the present moment. Mm-hmm. And then, these may not appear complimentary, but I'll say it anyway, because mm-hmm. we can do dumb things when we're asking questions. But I was reading your book.
Oh, that's not my book, but it's about me.
Well, yeah. It's kind of this one chapter thing. Yeah. And you had this great description of when you were a taxi driver, helping, you know, you were trained to help the lady out by grabbing her hand and her elbow.
And the elbow, yeah.
And you said it's really nice to have a sophisticated way to serve. Uh-huh. And so I'm always wrestling with this. Well, and for that to happen, you know, there had to be this taxi company that paid drivers, took care of cars, and made sure you were available
yes.
for the person who needed a ride. And so I've also been thinking, we just got to be here, fully here, fully available for here, but we also got to be thinking about being available next week.
Yes.
Next year.
Yes.
And, you know, and so how we come to trust the practice we're in and how we perpetuate the practice, and then even reading about how your Berkeley Zendo was kind of pushing you a little bit, like, well, we love you, but you probably aren't going to last forever, and you need to come up with a plan. And so seeing this plan that Bozeman's doing, it's kind of like, it's kind of cool that this is just drop in and not even know what's going to happen. It seems to be you guys are doing something like that.
Well, this is, you know, you bring up about 50 questions.
I know.
Well, yes, this is development. This is like the beginning of development. That's the way I see it. I mean, I'm not the boss, you know, but it's obvious. Like this now, but development, you know, takes sensitivity, a lot of sensitivity. Like some people will want to develop in a certain way. Other people will be a little reluctant to develop in a certain way. We like it the way it is. Do we have to change? Anything you do to change brings up something. People do not like change. Some people do, but so change, you know, you have to consider this, you have to consider that, you have to consider what's behind you, what's in front of you, before you make a decision. And I think that's slow, but it's solid. So if you're going to develop slowly and solidly, as soon as you get out of line a little bit, you think, well, I'll do this, you know. What are you doing? What are you doing? So you have to make sure, if you miss somebody, when you're making a decision, if you miss somebody that needs to know about that, they will cause you a problem, even if they agree with you. So, well, yes, being in the position of leadership is very difficult and tricky, because you have to be very sensitive to everybody, and you can't just do what you want. You can do what you want as long as you get everybody feeling that's okay. But it's diplomacy and sensitivity, but you know, that's just a kind of attitude. The specifics of no one knows. But what you were saying, just to be here, you know, that's a great koan, because where is here? Here is no longer here, but here is always here. It's always here, and it's nowhere. So it's emptiness. Here is emptiness, and out of emptiness goes all your activity. So when you know where you are, when you know that emptiness is where you are, then all kinds of things can happen. That's the basis. And then the activity comes out of that. So as long as you always know that that's the basis, then you can develop in a really fundamental way, and people will enjoy it. I don't remember what else you said, but it was a whole lot. So in our practice in Berkeley, I modeled it after Zen practice, because it's been, you know, studied with my teacher. And 1967 is when we started, and I'd only had 5 years of experience by that time. And so he asked me to find a place, because I was living in Berkeley, and people were sitting in somebody's house all the time and changing houses. So he asked me to find a place, and I just modeled it after Zen Center practice little by little, but on a small scale. So it's a kind of quasi-monastic practice. And then we have Zazen every day, we have Saturday program, we have sesshins, we have classes, we have study groups. It's a fairly concise group. You don't have to do that, you know. I don't think you can do that unless you have the experience of that kind of practice. And I see a lot of practices start up, small groups start up, but the leaders don't know what to do because they never had experience in that kind of practice that is, that our practice is based on. And so Karen has that experience, and if everybody grows together and not just, you know, one person out of leading the charge, you have to get everybody together to be reasonable about practice. If you're ever going to buy a place, all small Zen groups want to buy their own place. They have that idea. It's normal. But if you're going to do that, you have to have a sangha that's cohesive number of people that are dedicated to that project. It's easy for people to say, oh, let's do that. And then you start, and then everybody disappears. And two or three people are holding the bag. So you have to be very careful. Sanghas, in that young, small sanghas, membership is very fickle. Very fickle. People say, yeah, let's do that, let's do that. And you think that they're sincere. And they feel sincere. And that's why you think they're sincere, because they feel sincere at the time. But when it comes to money and responsibility, wait a minute. So you have to be really, there has to be a real spirit of wanting to do something where you know that everybody can trust each other. So, and I know that I saw the place that people are thinking of moving. It's not your place, thank goodness. But it's an office building, big place, and sharing it with the Vipassana does and the Tibetans, right? That could work. This is what happens in hinterlands, you know, away from the big cities. There's a few Zen students, a few Tibetans, isolated groups, small groups. Then they get together and practice together. You know, that's one way that happens. And, well, should we do Tibetan? Should we do Vipassana? Should we do Zen? And there's this kind of getting together and amalgamation and stuff. This is a little different. In Richmond, Virginia, where I go, there's a Zen group and a Tibetan group and a Vipassana group, and they share a building. But they don't they don't interfere with each other. They don't, you know, proselytize or do the same practices. They just, each one does its own practice. And that works. But the Zen group always wants to have its own place eventually. But I think this is probably a good, I don't think this is a bad idea, because each group is separate and they just want to share the place and they want to share the expense and so forth. And that sounds reasonable. If you were ever to get your own place, I think to just mark your time doing something like that would be reasonable. That's just my opinion. Yeah. Our practice is very formal. You know, it's just our Japanese practice that we got from our teacher. He didn't expect that we would do that all the time. And then the formality, formality is a very interesting thing. People look at a Zen group and think, well, it's a very formal practice. But actually, anything that's formal is just informal to the people that are practicing. To make formal practice is just informal. You know, for an American Indian, back in the 1850s, to watch people brush their teeth, use the clock, and march with guns, and that's really formal. But to everybody else, it's just informal. Right? It's just a way of doing things. Formality is. We don't think we're formal in our lives, but everything we do follows a certain pattern. And we do in a certain way. You know, you put the cream in your coffee, if you drink it, you stir it in a certain way. If you're right-handed, you stir it. If you're left-handed, you stir it this way. And you do the same way all the time. And doing it the same way all the time gives you some sense of form in your life. So because Zen is formless, you need some formality in order to know what you're doing. For Zen students, you just walk around with their arms down, you know, and it's good. You're in the nose, you know. You know, what is it, you know? So Zen, because it's empty, you have to give it some form. And the forms we inherit are forms that have been developed over 700 years or so, you know. So those forms are proven to work in a certain way. And the forms are very helpful. That's why they're there. They're not there to squeeze you into some kind of box, but to help you to practice. You don't have, every time you come in, you don't have to scratch your head and wonder what to do. You know what to do, and then you can do it. You sit in formal zazen, you walk, you sit in empty zazen, you sit in, you walk in empty qigong. Anyway. When we have this ceremony, we have to figure out how the both Wendy and Karen will do a jindo. Jindo is like when you walk around as a kind of greeting around the zendo. So they will walk around like this in front of all of you, and as they pass, you bow to them. And so, and then we'll come around and we'll proceed from there. It won't be long, but I want each one of them to say something, because it's their thing, not mine. Even though it looks like it's mine, but it's not mine, it's theirs, it's them. So, I think that the best way might be to push all the cushions against the wall, and I think we'll all fit around the perimeter if we do that.
And we'll do that after we chant the Heart Sutra?
Yeah, we'll do a little service. We'll chant the Heart Sutra, and then three bows. And then everybody three bows, and then we'll do that. So is this the fact, are you ending on time?
Mm-hmm. A few minutes, if you'd like to wrap up or take another question.
If there is any other question, you want to repeat anything you said?
Listen, I have a long list.
We can collapse time a little bit and start early. So we just sort of.
Service, we'll get back in the line, and then you'll just put yourself a little